Welcome to the Sustaining Injustice Podcast. This is your host, Kompas Temple.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Sustaining Injustice. Today, Kompas and this episode's guest discuss a variety of topics surrounding environmental economics, such as environmental justice, environmental policies, air pollution, and risk of hazardous environmental activities. Enjoy.
Hi, Tessa.
Hi, Kompas.
How's your day going?
It's pretty good. It's been long.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I know Tessa as a friend, colleague through the School of Sustainability. Tessa is getting an MS. I also know Tessa does some political marketing. I'll let Tessa give the standard introduction that we give here, social positionalities, some professional academic accomplishments, and what you like to do for fun, how you find rest.
Kompas for that kind introduction. Hi, everyone. My name is Tessa DeConcini. My pronouns are she, her. I am a female student here in the School of Sustainability. I'm getting a Master's of Science in Sustainability and a Certificate in Environmental and Sustainability Economics. I have an undergraduate degree from this very same institution, although from the ASU School of Politics and Global Studies, and that's a BA in Global Studies with a minor in Spanish Language Studies. I am half Arizonan, half Virginian. I grew up in Southern Virginia. I lived there for 14 years. And then I moved to Arizona. I am publicly educated. So I went to a public high school in Tucson, Arizona. And for those of you that don't know, Arizona is alternately 48th and 49th for public education. So although I'm not someone who studies education or education economics or anything like that, I'm really invested and interested in public education. And so I also went on to pursue a public education here at Arizona State University, and same for my graduate degree. Also, I'm white and I'm a U.S. citizen, so that affords me an enormous amount of privilege in life. And I'm lucky to live in a place where my family has lived for nearly a century. So I'm privileged and fortunate to be able to stand on their shoulders. In terms of things I'd like to do for fun and how I rest, I like reading and cooking. I'm recently getting into gardening, some pepper plants to take care of, so feeling energized by that quest, I guess. Hang out with my roommates. I'm really lucky to live in a household of loving and intelligent and wonderful people. So very grateful for them today and all days. But some significant, I guess, transitioning to my professional and academic background. So professionally, I've worked in the political sector for a number of years now at the local, state, and federal level. That's been for a brief summer in the U.S. Senate to a nonprofit for 3 years to now being a little over a year, well, I guess like a year and 4 months into a job at a political marketing, advertising, and strategy firm. So in that job, I guess I wear all hats. So I do all kinds of stuff from financial reporting and campaign finance to copywriting, which in the advertising world means I write things and then they get turned into other things like advertisements and endorsements and radio ads and things like that. I also do some translation there. So I'm really interested in learning more about the intersection between environmental justice and economic policy and policymaking, and how people in academia and people in the public sector can work together to produce just policy. I think I'll leave it there. Thanks for having me, Kompas.
Thank you for sharing, stepping into, I guess, this social positionality is, I think, that I feel like is an ongoing conversation for me. And it's cool to hear how folks just are engaging with their own identities and their own work. So I appreciate you publicly sharing that with us. We'll dive right on into it. So I've invited Tessa today to speak about air pollution monitoring using microeconomic theory. I don't know if you want to use that exact language. I do want to unpack some key questions in your work, how is this work relevant to sustainability and justice? And then maybe eventually we can get into defining key concepts that we might hit throughout the conversation.
Cool. So right now, I specifically study equitable air quality monitoring policy and distributive impacts of some of those monitoring decisions and what that looks like. So the question that I'm working on right now, or I guess the paper I'm writing and beginning to write and performing a data collection and background research and literature review on, is about what the effect of a specific EPA policy had on the composition and nature of the U.S. regulatory air quality monitoring system. So in the U.S., air quality monitoring and monitoring of pollution in general is regulated by a law called the Clean Air Act of 1970 and its subsequent amendments. And in that act, the EPA was created to enforce something called the NAAQS. So when you hear NAAQS, that stands for National Ambient Air Quality Standards. And those standards are routinely updated, put in place, and created anew depending on the situation and the pollutant that's discovered or by the Environmental Protection Agency or the EPA. And one of the things that the Clean Air Act regulates and monitors, or the primary thing it was created to monitor, are these things called criteria pollutants. So there's six criteria pollutants. Some of them you may be familiar with, like ozone and sulfur dioxide, and pollutant called particulate matter. So there's some others too, but those are the ones I'm more familiar with, particularly particulate matter. So if I say PM, that means particulate matter. There's two different kinds of particulate matter, PM 2.5, fine particulate matter, and PM10. I am more knowledgeable on PM 2.5 because it is the primary pollutant that we discuss in this air quality space when it comes to impacts on health outcomes. And we know that there are lots of issues with distributive impacts and exposure to hazardous limits of particulate matter. And it's kind of an interesting conversation because it's a pollutant that's in attainment in a lot of places where things like ozone and other criteria pollutants are in non-attainment. So these are some important terms to define as well. So attainment is when I'm referring to air quality or to criteria pollutants or the EPA in general, I guess, the Clean Air Act. So attainment is the legal allowable limit that a pollutant can have per microgram. We'll double check that. But the legal allowable limit of a pollutant within a given airspace or within a given concentration. So every criteria pollutant has a legal allowable limit, and if the limit is higher or the presence of that pollutant in the air sample is higher than that, then it is in non-attainment, which means it's above the legal allowable limit as dictated by the NAAQS and enforced by the EPA. So the reason that's important is because how do we know if something is in attainment or in non-attainment? Well, you got to monitor it. So the EPA requires that monitoring is undertaken to ensure that pollutants are in attainment or moving towards attainment for all of the places in the U.S. according to the limits set by the NAAQS. And how that is done is really interesting to me. So that's the roundabout version. Basically, I'm interested in understanding how that monitoring process works because, as you might be able to imagine, there's a lot of power in choosing how monitoring networks are designed and how they're implemented, how they're assessed, and how data from these monitors and the network in general is reported to the EPA, especially when there are very heavy fines and punishments for being outside of the legal allowable limit or being in non-attainment of the NAAQS. So maybe for some context, and we'll talk about this a little bit more as we get into it, but I'm very familiar at this point with the Maricopa County context of this monitoring institutional environment. And in Maricopa County currently, PM 2.5 is actually in attainment. So there's the legal allowable limit for PM is maintained here. While ozone, another well talked about pollutant, is in non-attainment. And the reason this is interesting to me, not just because of what we know about the impacts of ozone and particulate matter on human health and their interactions with each other, is because a lot of attention right now, both in the public sphere and the academic sphere, is being paid to addressing the ozone and non-attainment problem. Meanwhile, there's a lot of literature that suggests that the distributive impacts of particulate matter may have massive long-term consequences for human health. So then the questions arise, okay, well, how do we know that it's in attainment? Where is it being measured to assure that it's in attainment? And who live near those areas where levels are being measured? Is it equitable or is it equal? Does it matter? And how do we assess the monitoring network in order to evaluate for environmental justice concerns like equity, equitable distribution, some of the other things that I've talked about? And who are the populations that we should be concerned about when it comes to environmental justice? So,
awesome. I appreciate that synopsis of your work. It's always, I don't know, I feel like it's a bear to describe what you do in like 5 minutes to people. Well, I just want to pull some of those concepts and questions out just for our listeners here as we move forward in this conversation, just to keep in mind. So I remember you mentioning, how do you know if pollutants are within attainment? That's going to be a key question of our conversation today. And I remember you mentioning having expertise in Maricopa County. And I think Maricopa County includes about 20 self-governing cities. Is that right?
You know, I'm not sure on the count, but what's important, I think, to note about Maricopa County and why it's an interesting case, not only is it the place where we are currently recording this podcast and where we live and where our university is and where massive amounts of academic and public funding are channeled in the state of Arizona, but it's also the home of the fastest growing city in the U.S., which is Phoenix, Arizona, and it's also the home of the fifth largest city in the U.S. It's a very diverse, not only in terms of population characteristics, in terms of land and land use characteristics, or it's a very diverse county in terms of those things, but we have Maricopa County spans a very large part of Arizona and includes hyper urban areas and very, very rural areas. And the differences between those parts of the county are stark. And the way that we monitor air pollution is important when we try to talk about how impacts might be different for individuals throughout the county and throughout the state of Arizona in general, and places like it in different parts of the U.S. So some distinguishing characteristics about Maricopa County, aside from its diverse makeup and land use, but it's also a desert region. And Phoenix is a high elevation valley city, which means that a lot of pollution questions about max concentrations and where pollutants migrate to and the effect that air has on individuals might be easier. I mean, this is debatable in the literature, of course, but might be easier to isolate and understand because of the characteristics of our city. And it might also mean that they're more potent or their effects on human health might be more severe. Additionally, Phoenix and Maricopa County in general, especially, and I guess notably, the rural areas on the outskirts, the western outskirts of the county, are downwind of the Los Angeles metropolitan region and Southern California in general, where tons of pollution blows from, and also highly agricultural. So when we're talking about particulate matter, that is a key distinguisher, not only here in Arizona and in Maricopa County, but throughout the U.S. Agricultural areas are big hotspots for particulate matter exposure, as are highly urban areas.
I just wanted to clarify two other points, both differences between micro and macro economics. How would you yourself differentiate those two terms in your work? And what is more significant to you, less significant to you? In addition to, how are you defining environmental justice in your work?
That is a great question to ask right now, because a lot of how I frame these discussions and how my interests are framed and also my methodologies and the literature that I consult have to do with microeconomic principles. So the way that I define micro and the way that I think it's pretty conventionally defined is microeconomics is like little picture economics. So it's concerned with how market forces affect behavior at the individual, group, and company levels. And when we're talking about its context in environmental policy and environmental economics in general, that usually means that we're thinking about how behaviors of certain actors can impact outcomes. In my case or my field, what I'm going to be thinking about is, okay, how are market interventions, policy interventions, affect the way that consumers, as well as agents of power, policymakers, and firms react to certain incentives. So the primary policy intervention that I'm going to be talking about is the Clean Air Act, its amendments, and then updates to federal code, which is the kind of main interest of my specific research question, but how this grouping of public policy affects not just health outcomes, but outcomes and distribution of risk, distribution of costs for air pollution improvements and benefits of air pollution improvements, and also costs and benefits of being exposed to different levels of air pollution. And what's interesting is I think that a lot of people, when they think about economics or think about problems that they have with economic problem solving or economic framing, I tend to find out that they have problems with macroeconomic theory or the way that macro could be applied to a certain conversation topic. So the way that I'm defining macroeconomics today, and that I think it's generally defined, is as the study of the national economy as a whole, or how national economies interact with each other on a global scale, and how all markets together interact to generate big phenomena or aggregate variables. So thinking about macro, that's going to be thinking about like unemployment rate and big questions about labor participation. And also lots of times it includes things like taxes on imports and exports and competitive advantage and comparative advantage and things like that. So those are all very interesting questions and subjects to me as well, but it's not the kind of theory I'm going to be relying on primarily for this paper or this field of research.
I appreciate you clarifying what is micro macroeconomics. And just for listeners, other examples might include emission standards, fees, subsidies. If you heard of cap and trade, that is another policy that could be studied from a microeconomic lens.
And just to note on that, most environmental economic topics and papers and literature in general is micro and using micro principles. Of course, there are some others in there that are important and enlightening as well.
So for this conversation, Tessa sent me some readings that, would you say, guided your thought in this work?
Yeah, or they're ones that I've cited or, you know, maybe thought more critically on.
We'll also include the full names and titles of these articles in the show notes. We're looking at Paul Mohai's and Robin Saha's Reassessing Racial and Socioeconomic Disparities in Environmental Justice Research. And that was an article published in 2006. And then another article published in 2007, Criteria Air Pollution and Marginalized Populations, Environmental Inequity in the Metropolitan Phoenix, Arizona area. And then there's a paper roughly about 7 years ago, Spatial Patterns of Air Pollutants in Social Groups, a GTPIV environmental justice study in the Phoenix metropolitan region of the USA. As a person that is not studying this on a day-to-day basis, what I took away from it is there are, especially in the 2006 paper, Mohai and Saha kind of highlighted that there are different ways to measure air pollution, and some are better than others considering specific spatial variables, so how we consider space, or temporal variables, how we consider time. The 2007 article and 2016 article are specific to Phoenix, looking at how we've monitored air pollution in this area here. I'll hand it over to the expertise on these articles. What key themes are significant to consider from these articles, and maybe just for your work generally?
Well, I think some key themes when it comes to economic perspectives on environmental justice research, especially in the air quality space, include, or I guess what I'm interested in or what sticks out to me from these papers, is this broader discussion of how do we measure and how do we prove that those are the right measures. So economics in general is a primarily quantitative field. Of course, there's lots of qualitative work that's done in conjunction or alongside some more traditional economic modeling and data collection and things like that. And I would consider myself at this point a more quantitative researcher as well. That's what I'm interested in right now. Those are the methods that engage and excite me. But something that I think a lot of traditional economic literature has lacked is acknowledgement of context and how important contextual information is for understanding what's going on, and also understanding who is being benefited and who is being hurt by different policy interventions or decisions not to intervene. So these papers kind of discuss not only the relationship between air pollution and different kinds of social groups, but also how those relationships can produce disparities in the way that we do environmental justice research and economic research, but also how that research is used to produce policy that will inevitably be implemented at the local, state, and federal level.
Thinking about these articles, how are you building off maybe these themes or questions that these scholars have left us with?
Let's back up and go to this Pope paper. This paper, it's called Spatial Patterns of Air Pollutants and Social Groups, a Distributive Environmental Justice Study in the Phoenix Metropolitan Region of USA. And it's written by a past ASU PhD student and two professors at ASU that are both still here and appointed jointly in the School of Sustainability and other schools within the university. And this paper kind of talks about how these authors were using specific spatial analysis methods to understand how different social groups are differently or similarly exposed to certain air pollutants, and doing so through a distributive environmental justice lens. So maybe we'll get into this a little bit more, but distributive along with procedural and recognition justice are three areas that are important for understanding the impacts of air quality monitoring and hazardous pollution exposure, not only in Phoenix, but everywhere in the US and everywhere in the world. And it's important to think critically about how we measure justice, how we define justice, and how we measure air pollution, how we define it, and how we model it. So they're using a spatial analysis to answer their research questions, and they're modeling it spatially to try to understand how different racial groups and different socioeconomic groups might be more likely to be exposed to certain pollutants at certain levels. So in Phoenix, we know that there's a really stark and observable difference between different racial groups and socioeconomic groups. And the way that we measure that helps us understand that to an extent. But if we aren't ready or willing to think critically about where the faults in those measurements may be, and also where their strengths may be, then we might be missing out on some important ways to acknowledge justice and better serve historically marginalized and underserved populations. In Phoenix, particularly, Hispanic groups, Native American, and Black African American groups are far more likely to be exposed to hazardous levels of air pollution for pretty much all criteria air pollutants, and toxic air contaminants, which we will not be talking about today, but is another big subject for air pollution researchers, as well as low-income populations. But what's interesting is that these local and regional implementary regulatory bodies, which are the Maricopa County Air Quality Department and the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, how they are responsible for acknowledging those groups in their assessment techniques and also ensuring that justice is, by whatever extent, provided. And here and there lies the question and the interest and the intersection between environmental justice and economic methodologies in the air pollution space. So in Maricopa County, they produce an assessment every 5 years of the air quality monitoring network. And it includes an assessment of a, quote, environmental justice variable, which is highly subjective. So it's chosen by the regulator and is monitored or evaluated and assessed, by the regulator that produces the assessment, which they turn into the state and to the EPA. And the environmental justice variable that they assess for in Maricopa County is minority population density served. And that denotes a certain methodology for measuring that population and also what that population is. So they're not talking about low-income groups. They're not talking about combined variables like likelihood to be minority and likelihood to be low-income and whatever other environmental justice variables you might suggest, but just population served by minority density or minority population density. And then the method that they do to evaluate that and assess that and produce a quantity, so quantify this environmental justice variable in order to assess efficacy of the network, is by using a certain mathematical technique called a Thessian polygon, which they use to determine coverage of the air quality monitors and who lives within that coverage zone, basically. And the reason this example is important and not just a long-winded digression from the topic at hand is because it's different everywhere in the U.S. There's really limited instruction from the EPA and from states on how best to do this, and it varies. So there's more instruction in California, for instance, than there is in Arizona or probably other states where there are limited, underfunded, and less justice-focused regulatory agencies in charge of evaluating for justice.
So what I am taking away from what you were just sharing about the Pope paper, but also key themes of how we monitor air pollution, is that there are different ways to understand what justice is and different ways to understand how justice will be achieved. And of course, what is justice itself and how is that defined? In the environmental justice literature, there's traditionally been a lot of attention to distribution. Would you align your work primarily with distribution, or are you also trying to integrate, think about other pieces of environmental justice?
That's a great question because this is something I'm currently working on right now to figure out. So a lot of the previous literature, including the literature that we're discussing right now and that I have relied and benefited from heavily, focuses on distributive justice. But I am starting to think, or maybe no, I don't think I'm thinking about it anymore, that part of what's lacking in this literature and perhaps what I can contribute to, perhaps even minorly, but something that other researchers can build on more, is to think about how different kinds of justice, so namely for me, that will be distributive justice, procedural justice, and recognition justice, interact together in the way that we evaluate policy and how policy evaluates for justice, or policy, I guess, requires evaluation for justice. In the academic literature, there's been a strong focus on distributive justice. Meanwhile, in the public sector, so for instance, these assessments that I mentioned earlier, that's a public, you know, publication by the regulator who, interestingly, Ronald Pope, who is the key author of this academic paper we were talking about, is and now works at Maricopa County Air Quality Department and writes a lot of these things or helps co-author them, which is interesting. I don't have a lot of additional knowledge beyond that, but illustrates the importance between academic and public exchange and why reviewing both of these literatures is important, especially for these justice questions. Because in the public sphere, I think there's been a stronger reliance or broader discussion about procedural justice. And I would venture to guess that that's probably because that's how we think in the U.S. and how policy is made is based on legal determinants and legal boundaries and definitions of justice, and how our legal system and our political and public systems acknowledge and define justice, which for the most part, I think is primarily procedural. But the subject of recognition justice is interesting because perhaps it has the potential to bridge this communication gap or definition gap between evaluating, assessing for procedural justice indicators and understandings and versus distributive justice indicators and understandings. Because recognition justice, at least for my base understanding at this point in my research, I'm imagining it will look something like thinking about how defining not only what certain groups are or how justice pertains to certain groups. So what does minority mean in the air pollution context? What does low income mean? Should they be weighted evenly? What does the scientific literature say about what is more likely to be an important indicator of risk versus what is important for understanding how public policy is passed? Because we can harp on and on and on about an important part of justice without ever getting to the point of the discussion where we think about how it would be turned into policy that is actionable and demonstrable in the public sphere. And those conversations are important. So I'm thinking that recognition justice will help me understand how public policy actors, so people who are writing public policy, and then also researchers like myself who are researching public policy and public policy outcomes, help us understand how defining justice and defining groups that are of interest for environmental justice can also help us understand their risk through recognizing the burden that they shoulder, not just legally or spatially or based on their concentrations or densities within certain census block groups, but through understanding identities and exposure and historical patterns and histories themselves that create identities.
I appreciate that contextualization of what distributive procedural and recognition justice, what that actually looks like for your work. And for listeners, when I'm referring to these three different types of environmental justice, I'm thinking about a scholar named David Schlossberg, who wrote an article in 2004 that referenced these different types of justice. And he also drew from scholars like Nancy Fraser, who highlighted the significance of recognition justice in addition to distributive environmental impact. So that could range from how close people are to a waste facility, to understandings of air pollution, to impacts of water waste on a particular community. In my work, relative location to a mine and who specifically is impacted by the implementation and opening of a mine.
Well, I think there's where we can exchange a lot, even probably literature, because a lot of what I study or the research that I consult has to do with where people live in relation to air pollution monitors themselves. So how people exist in the context of a network that's monitoring their pollution exposure, and also lots of times where those polluters are. So that's not the paper that I'm writing right now, but it is an important part of the conversation in general, because where people live determines their life quality and their experience in a whole bunch of different ways, of course, and how we define those criteria is important for understanding the stories that we tell and the policy that we write and the research that we do. So thinking about who lives close to a monitor is interesting to me, or who lives far, I guess, is probably the better question. Who lives far from a monitor? Is it fair? Why would it be a problem if people live far from monitors? And how do we recognize that those burdens and those risks are different because of spatial distribution? So I'm sure you have more to comment. I'd like to hear about how you might relate that to your research context.
What we're talking about makes me want to talk about risk. Are you down to talk about risk?
I don't know the risk literature that well, but I can talk about it informally. Let you know if I have no idea what we're talking about.
The reason why I think about risk is, I guess you've mentioned, who exactly is exposed to environmental risk? And in this case, in our conversation about air pollutants, we're talking about particulate matter and ozone, especially in the Maricopa County areas. And some groups, it could be racial groups, it could be socioeconomic groups, it could be an intersection of these groups combined, but these groups are exposed and have the potential to be exposed to more or less risk. And how we think about risk is significant. For example, in my work, I'm studying the Stibnite Gold Project, which is a mine located in Idaho. There are multiple tribal reservations located within the radius of the mine. This mine permitting process is proceeding. That risk imposed on tribal reservations is maybe not even being perceived as a risk. That is where I'm coming from on the topic of risk. Do you have thoughts about your own work?
Yeah. As a disclosure, I am not a risk scholar, and I am not doing work necessarily on risk. However, I think the way that I would phrase it in my work, or basically what could be included in discussion, these discussions of risk, is like, what outcomes are possible and how do they change based on your exposure to air pollution and your proximity to the vehicle, not literal, that we use to understand what that pollution is. Pollution in general, we care about pollution in the mine context or in air pollution context because it's a negative externality or a negative outcome of production. So they're not just digging a hole for no reason for the mine, of course, like they're extracting something, no. Here in the rural parts of Maricopa County, we're not doing mass, like large-scale agriculture just for funsies. We're producing something that then can be consumed by our own residents and shipped elsewhere to be consumed by others or whatever. And in the urban context, you know, we're not just driving cars around for no good reason. We are using them as a tool to either perform some kind of task that is productive or to enhance our productive capacity in our economy. And pollution is created because of those outcomes, because we have mechanized in order to produce things. And I'm sure you could do a whole episode on the history of the Industrial Revolution and capitalism and productive capacities and whatever. That's not today. But risk then enters the conversation, because when there is the ability for pollution to be created through production, it exists and will exist in a place or a space that is shared by other beings. So my research particularly focuses on human beings. Of course, you could extend these research questions and risk literature in general, I think, to include non-human beings as well and land itself as a group, perhaps. I'm not doing that, though. But I'm interested in understanding, and I think air pollution literature and research is interesting in general because we can explore how exposure to this negative externality of production in our economy and of the way that we live our lives in general is ununiformly distributed among different populations. And if you are more exposed, you are at greater risk for negative health outcomes. So for particulate matter, that's like, could be all kinds of stuff, like all kinds of respiratory illnesses, cardiac events, different kinds of cancers, problems seeing, breathing. You know, there is a very robust literature of bad things that can happen to you when you're exposed to particulate matter, but all different air pollutants, that's why they're regulated. Because some scientists and policymakers realized that they were unhealthy and damaging humans and the environment. And if you are close to a place where those concentrations are high, your risk of having a negative outcome is likely higher. If you're far from a place where concentrations are higher, you live in a place where concentrations are low, your risk is likely lower. But if we were just looking at space alone, it wouldn't tell us that much about why people live where they do, which is why looking at these demographic questions and these environmental justice variables and particular groups like in your research that have been historically marginalized or discriminated against is important, because risk is not just a question of space, place, and time. It's also a question of long-term discrimination, access to resources, and a whole host of other things that I'm sure we could list for days.
As you were talking, I also wanted to recognize that we're academic researchers, and maybe I'm not making claims for what social group should do. And I think in this work of air pollution, we're just hoping maybe to say, hey, this is what's happening as a result of this policy or action. It's not a claim for these social groups should do this specific thing or task to change. These groups have been active in articulating their concern of risk and exposure to these things. So I want to acknowledge the social movements and conversations mm-hmm. these groups are leading themselves, the Nez Perce, particularly racialized communities in Maricopa County, mm-hmm. to talk about air pollution.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to bring up, because similarly, I mean, I can't speak for your work, but the capacity to do something or to do something to reduce your risk or limit your risk or change who is at risk is like low. The ability for a rich white individual to move somewhere else in the county or outside of a county entirely in order to reduce their risk to a certain pollutant is much higher than someone from a marginalized group that may not have the same access to resources or something like that. That is not to say, though, that this is something that just is the way that it is. And yet, Phoenix was redlined and there's nothing we can do about it. And low income and minority populations will just be discriminated against because that's how it is. Of course, that is not the picture and that is not the solution. Rather, it highlights the importance of understanding why public policy is an important tool to understanding and acknowledging, recognizing, and resolving risk, or I guess rather the inequitable distribution of hazard, but also why it's important that we mobilize on a social level. The communities that have the greatest capacity to do something about their risk are also the loudest and the most powerful and the most active in ensuring that their risk is limited. But they are not at greatest risk, or I guess comparably. So what do we do as a society? And what do we do as academic researchers? And what do we do about people who may be involved in political policy making, or our research may be, you know, knowingly or unknowingly used in policy production to help invigorate other ways that we have to enact and promote justice, including, you know, social mobilization.
Before our concluding remarks, what does this mean for sustainability and injustice broadly? How does that connect to maybe not only just the scholarly conversations, but also public discourse on both sustainability and justice of air quality monitoring? And a key question I want to consider in this space is, how might these policies regarding air pollution, how might they be sustaining justice? How have they sustained injustice? And in a policy like the Clean Air Act, I would in my mind, I would think, oh, that's great. They're doing something great for the environment, should be great for everyone. But I think there probably needs to be a more critical question asked of, is this actually sustaining justice? Is this sustaining injustice? How do you engage with that question in your work?
I think I'm continually revising how I engage with that question, because it's a lot of little questions, you know, smushed together about how do I think about justice? What is the role of justice in policy versus academia? And how do I fit into that space? I mean, in a very literal way, I split my time between spaces and I engage with policy and politics heavily outside of school and my work here. And I spend the other half of my time here researching and studying and learning. And the way that I talk and think about justice is different in those spaces. But the morals and the way that I think about being and knowing and my imperative when it comes to justice are the same in both of those spaces. And in my social life and, you know, at the dinner table and everything, like those things carry through my different spheres of life. And two, I think it's important to discuss as academics and as researchers about how we can translate those important concepts and our values into things that policymakers and constituents and groups that we may be talking to or talking about, also important to distinguish, how we can translate those for their proactive use and as a way to perhaps destabilize the status quo or the existing systems of oppression and inequality that have promoted, maintained, and protected oppression and injustice in our societies. I think the concrete example when it comes to air quality monitoring is specifically that when we're looking at a city like Phoenix in Maricopa County, it's a highly redlined city that has a deep history of inequality, and the roots of injustice are deep here, not just in terms of how land is used and where populations live, but the political and social and historical context that gave rise to those patterns. On the sustaining justice part of your question, I'm hoping that my work and this work in general and discussions about air quality monitoring in a place that has these histories, and of course, this can be scaled up to the U.S. The U.S. has these histories and these injustices that make up our political system, that make up our academic institutions, that give power in academia and give power in politics and policymaking. Understanding how our research will inevitably be used by different actors in different spaces, and how we can hopefully promote and bake in methods to destabilize systems of oppression into our work so that they can be used to those ends by a variety of different actors. And while economics is not traditionally the field that speaks boldly about those values, and perhaps in publications I may not speak in these exact terms, but I think it's important that economists and sustainability researchers in general and sustainability policymakers, students, faculty, recognize that we have extraordinary power to do something about it, even if it's just with our words or with the writing that we put in between the lines for others to read, you know? And for me, working with those strong values is where I'm starting and where I will continue to grow from.
I love the phrase, destabilize systems of oppression through your work in economics. Because like you said, it isn't typically maybe a space that you see economics and the phrase systems of oppression in the same space. We're at time here. Do you have any concluding remarks?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thank you so much for having me for this beautiful board that you made. This was a great conversation. I love talking about this stuff. If there are any listeners that are interested in speaking further about air quality, air pollution monitoring, economics, either to give me some insight or to gain some insight from me, please feel free to reach out to me. My email is tdeconci@asu.edu. And thanks for having me. This was great.
Awesome. Thanks for joining.
All right, folks. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. We hope you enjoyed. Make sure to come back next week for a brand new episode on institutional dynamics and sustainability.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Sustaining Injustice Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider liking, subscribing, and sharing the podcast. My hope at Sustaining Injustice is to make our content open access. So we ask, if you have the financial capacity, please consider supporting us on our Substack site with a subscription or a one-time gift. Thank you all for supporting the project.